Chapter 37. General Kelly informed the president that his two top foreign policy advisers, McMaster and Tillerson, were in a ferocious fight over who would negotiate with Saudi Arabia to get $4 billion. The money was in part to fund operations in Syria, including a top-secret CIA project for the Syrian rebels, codenamed Teak. Getting foreign governments to fund U.S. military and CIA operations in foreign countries remained one of Trump's biggest goals. "Damn HR," Trump said. "This pointy-head academic has no sense of business or how to negotiate." Kelly agreed. McMaster was not the guy for the job and so far had not been very successful with the Saudis. They were often willing to write big checks for a variety of projects in Syria. According to Tillerson, McMaster had stepped in and said, "I'm reaching out to my counterparts in Saudi. I'm going to negotiate directly with them." The president was furious. Even with a multitude of problems with Tillerson, at least he had experience cutting deals with the Saudi royal family for years as the Exxon CEO. Tillerson also knew the Saudis could not be trusted, and for Trump, not trusting the people on the other side of the table was a first principle of haggling, of beating them down to get a better bargain. You had to be tough and say no to get yes. Why the hell would McMaster take this away from Tillerson? It doesn't make any sense, he said. But there was a more pressing matter that day, January 19, 2018, one day short of Trump's first full year. In several secure phone conversations with President Moon Jae-in of South Korea, Trump had intensified his criticism of the CORUS trade agreement between the two countries. He would not let go of the $18 billion trade deficit and the $3.5 billion expense of stationing 28,500 U.S. troops. The refrain was jeopardizing relations with Moon, whom he disliked. Trump's obsessive and unfiltered venting had brought him to the edge once again. Trump told Moon he wanted to send a 180-day termination letter and destroy the trade relationship. "You guys are ripping us off," he said. He wanted the trade and security issues separated. "I'm done just giving you guys free money." Moon replied that trade and security were intertwined. "We want to work with you," the South Korean president said. He was conciliatory. "You're one of our allies, one of our partners. There may be some misunderstanding about the economic relationship. We want to come to an understanding." Trump was amped up. "You've got to pay for the THAAD anti-ballistic missile system. Why do we need to have any of our anti-ballistic system there?" He belittled the CORUS trade agreement, South Korea, and its new leader. This barely concealed rage at an ally was magnificently undiplomatic, the way the president often liked it. He was on the verge of blowing up the relationship. Kelly, McMaster, Tillerson, and Mattis joked darkly that it was inexplicable that the president was voicing more ire at South Korea than our adversaries, China, Russia, Iran, Syria, and North Korea. The senior White House staff and national security team were appalled. They didn't know what the president might say or do. This was an important relationship, especially at that moment. They had to shut this down. There was a consensus that something needed to be done before Moon decided he'd had enough. McMaster set up a National Security Council meeting in the Situation Room for January 19, 2018. The meeting was billed as a discussion of issues related to South Korea among the president and the principals, Tillerson, Mattis, Kelly, McMaster, Dunford, Cohn. Trump got right to his point. "What do we get by maintaining a massive military presence in the Korean Peninsula?" he asked, returning to his obsession with the money and the troops. "And even more than that," he went on, "what do we get from protecting Taiwan, say?" He had always seen this as a worldwide problem. The United States paying for the defense of others in Asia, the Middle East, and NATO. "Why are we even friends with South Korea?" he wanted to know. What do we get out of this? He had been fuming for a year. The answers were insufficient. Mattis and General Dunford once more explained the benefit was immense. We get a stable democracy in a part of the world where we really need it, Mattis said. South Korea was one of the strongest bastions, free elections, and a vibrant capitalism. South Korea had a population of 50 million people, the 27th largest country in the world, but with an economy that was the 11th largest and a GDP of $1.5 trillion, the same as Russia's. Trump had been informed about the EDGE, the Special Access Program intelligence operations gave the United States, in detecting a North Korean missile launch, 7 seconds versus 15 minutes from Alaska. There was also an offensive cyber attack capability. It had mixed results, sabotaging North Korean missiles before or after launch. Mattis showed signs that he was tired of the disparaging of the military and intelligence capability, and of Trump's unwillingness to comprehend their significance. "We're doing this in order to prevent World War III," Mattis said. He was calm but stark. It was a breathtaking statement, a challenge to the president, suggesting he was risking nuclear war. Time stopped for more than one in attendance. One person present said Mattis's message was clear. "Stop fucking around with this. We're doing this because we've got to prevent World War III. This isn't some business gamble where if you happen to go bankrupt or whatever, it's not a big deal." It seemed Mattis and others were at the end of their rope with the president. How are you possibly questioning these things that are obvious and so fundamental? It was as if Mattis were saying, "God, stop it." Mattis was not finished. "We have the ability to defend the homeland with forward deployment of the 28,500 troops." He was reluctant to mention the special access programs in such a large meeting. Mattis explained, without the intelligence capability and the troops, the risk of war would vastly increase. The means of defending South Korea and Japan would be decreased. If there was a war without these assets, the only option left is the nuclear option. We can't achieve the same deterrent effect in any other way, and we can't do it as cost-effectively. The arrangement with South Korea was one of the great national security bargains of all time. Mattis tried to speak the president's language of cost-benefit analysis. "But we're losing so much money in trade with South Korea, China, and others," Trump countered. "I'd rather be spending money on our own country." The United States was subsidizing others with the trade imbalances. "Other countries," Trump went on, "who've agreed to do security things for us only do it because they're taking so much of our money. They were almost stealing from us." "Forward-positioned troops provide the least costly means of achieving our security objectives, and withdrawal could lead our allies to lose all confidence in us," Mattis replied. Chairman Dunford stepped in, seconding all these points with some passion. "We're spending massive amounts for very rich countries who aren't burden-sharing," Trump said, hammering his point. Then, out of the blue, he raised what Kelly had told him about the McMaster and Tillerson feud over who would negotiate with the Saudis to get the $4 billion for operations in Syria and elsewhere. He said he had heard McMaster had urged Tillerson to back off. He laid into his national security advisor. "Why would you do that?" he asked McMaster. "The Saudis are confused. This is $4 billion. Rex is going to do this. HR, stay out of it. I have no idea why you possibly would have thought that it was wise for you to take it away from Rex, but steer clear. Rex is going to do this. He's going to handle it." McMaster took the dressing down in stride. He had been insulted in front of the National Security Council he was supposed to lead and coordinate. McMaster, a chain of command general, replied, "Yes, sir." Tillerson, on the other hand, turned back to the main issue, the value of forward deployment. "It's the best model. The global system, joining together in trade and geopolitics, leads to good security outcomes. Dunford again supported his argument. Our forward-deployed cost in South Korea is roughly $2 billion. South Korea reimburses us for over $800 million of that. We don't seek reimbursement for the cost of our troops, such as their pay. The chairman also said that other countries were paying the U.S. an annual subsidy for activities we would engage in anyway for our own protection. We're getting $4 billion a year subsidy in our efforts to protect the homeland, Dunford said. I think we could be so rich, Trump said, if we weren't stupid. We're being played as suckers, especially NATO. Collective defense was a sucker play. Citing a number often used by Bannon for the financial sacrifice and cost of all the wars, military presence, and foreign aid in the Middle East, the president summed up, "We have spent $7 trillion in the Middle East. We can't even muster $1 trillion for domestic infrastructure." The president left. Among the principals, there was exasperation with these questions. Why are we having to do this constantly? When is he going to learn? They couldn't believe they were having these conversations and had to justify their reasoning. Mattis was particularly exasperated and alarmed, telling close associates that the president acted like and had the understanding of a fifth or sixth grader. When I first learned of the details of this NSC meeting, I went back to a transcript of what President Obama had told me in 2010 about what he worried about the most. A potential game changer, Obama said, would be a nuclear weapon blowing up a major American city. And so when I go down the list of things I have to worry about all the time, that is at the top, because that's one area where you can't afford any mistakes. And right away, coming in, we said, how are we going to start ramping up and putting that at the center of a lot of our national security discussion? Make sure that that occurrence, even if remote, never happens. The pressure campaign on North Korea was effectively put on hold while the 2018 Winter Olympics were held in South Korea from February 9th to the 25th. General Dunford learned that the Air Force had planned some research and design tests of its nuclear-capable ballistic missiles from California into the Pacific Ocean, scheduled right before and after the Olympics. They were the kind of tests that the United States was pressuring North Korea to stop. They were provocative. He stepped in, and the Air Force held off on the tests. Early in 2018, the CIA concluded that North Korea did not have the capability to accurately deliver a missile into the United States mainland with a nuclear weapon on top. According to the intelligence and the information on the testing of North Korean rockets, they did not have the reentry of missiles perfected. But they were marching toward that goal. The CIA, for the moment, seemed to convince Trump that the North was not yet there. Chapter 38. Afghanistan continued to frustrate Trump. Months earlier, in late September, he had hosted a reception at the United Nations annual meeting in New York. Azerbaijan President Ilham Aliyev and his wife posed for a picture with the Trumps. The Azerbaijan leader passed word that the Chinese were mining substantial amounts of copper from Afghanistan. Trump was furious. Here was the United States paying billions for the war, and China was stealing copper. Afghan President Ghani had dangled the possibility that the United States would have exclusive access to vast mineral wealth untouched in the Afghanistan mountain ranges. His argument? There's so much money to be made. Don't walk away. Rare earth minerals, including lithium, a main ingredient in the latest batteries. Some exaggerated estimates held that all minerals in Afghanistan might be worth as much as several trillion dollars. Trump wanted the minerals. They have offered us their minerals, he said at one meeting. Offered us everything. Why aren't we there taking them? You guys are sitting on your ass. The Chinese are raiding the place. Sir, said Gary Cohn, it's not like we just walk in there and take the minerals. They have no legal system, no land rights. It would cost billions of dollars to build the mining infrastructure, he added. We need to get a company in there, Trump said. Put it out for bid. This was a giant opportunity. Capitalism, building and development at its best. Why aren't we in there taking it? Who's we? Cohn asked. We should just be in there taking it, Trump said, as if there were a national mining company to move into Afghanistan. At a subsequent meeting in the Oval Office, Trump asked, Why hasn't this been done? We're running it through the NSC process, McMaster said. I don't need it done through a fucking process, Trump yelled. I need you guys to go in there and get this stuff. It's free. Who wants to do this? It was a free-for-all. Who wanted this bonanza? Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross volunteered. I'll take care of it, sir. I'll do it, he said, as if it were a Commerce Department issue. Trump approved. Kelly didn't say much, but took McMaster, Ross, and Cohn to his office. McMaster was rip-shit at Kelly for not intervening. You just chopped my legs out from me. You knew I was running a process. He was going by the textbook as usual, was working with the state and defense departments and any other departments or agencies with an interest. You hung me out to dry in front of the president. There was little that appealed to Trump more than the idea of getting money from others to pay for national security commitments made by previous U.S. administrations, NATO, Afghanistan, Iraq. The only other appealing prospect was making a good deal, and he thought this was one. The State Department assessed the mineral rights. Analysts concluded this would be a great propaganda boon to worldwide extremists. The United States is coming to rape your land and steal your wealth from the ground. They sought legal opinions in hopes of slowing it down. On February 7, 2018, McMaster convened a small group of principals in the Situation Room to hear Commerce Secretary Ross's report. He had talked with the acting Minister of Mining in Afghanistan that morning. The Chinese are not getting anything out. They have these big concessions, as they do worldwide, and they sit on them. They're in it for the long term. They don't need to make immediate money off it. So there was nothing to worry about. Afghanistan did not have the infrastructure or transportation, the regulatory or environmental controls, he said. No private company would make an investment. It's fake news, Ross said to mild laughter. McMaster added that most of these minerals would be impossible to reach because a lot of them were in Taliban-controlled areas. It was a war zone, and a military perimeter defense would have to be established before mining. At best, he said, it would take 10 years if everything went right. Ross said he would follow up to explain this to the president. Kelly seemed to be just trying to keep the ship from sinking. At a senior staff meeting in early 2018, he announced with pride, I now know that I will not be the shortest-serving chief of staff. I've now surpassed Reince. Priebus had served 189 days, the shortest tenure of any White House chief of staff in history. Early in 2018, 60 Minutes broadcast a piece on the Afghanistan war, noting that Kabul was so violent that the U.S. commander could not be safely driven to his headquarters through the city. General Nicholson flew the 2 miles by helicopter. He made it clear he had adopted Trump's victory-driven approach. This is a policy that can deliver a win, Nicholson said. Nicholson's intelligence and operational maps showed that the U.S.-led coalition controlled about 50% of the country. Within knowledgeable Pentagon and State Department circles, it was known that Nicholson had claimed, I'll get to 80% in 2 years. He was determined to enhance the coalition's and Afghan army's capability to claw back what would amount to 75,000 square miles. It was unattainable, even preposterous to many who had served in Afghanistan. A secondary goal of Nicholson's was that after 4 years, the Taliban would realize they could not win and would come to the negotiating table. This was the same Taliban that had been fighting for 16 years. The DNI intelligence expert briefed Trump on Afghanistan in early 2018. No gains by the U.S. in territory. Nothing clawed back. No improvement from last year. Actually, some areas were getting worse. Part of the explanation was that the U.S. and Afghans had to guard Kabul as the Taliban mounted attack after attack on the capital. In the last 9 days of January, 130 people were killed in 4 attacks. This left little coalition military capacity to take back territory. The analysts had more grim conclusions. Pakistan was not playing ball or responding to pressure. Any settlement was premised on Pakistani participation. The immediate prospect was more insurgency, maybe even civil war if the U.S. pulled out. Jihadists were coming out of Syria and heading to Afghanistan, the new promised land for bomb makers and bomb throwers. The coalition probably only had until the spring of 2019 to keep the status quo. The political fabric seemed to be coming apart. A perfect storm was coming, and a practical problem like weather might be the tipping point. The mountains had little to no snow, so no water was coming down to the fields. A drought was coming, and with it, a crisis of food insecurity. Around the same time, Pakistan was likely to send 1 to 2 million refugees over the border into Afghanistan, many of them Afghans who had crossed the border into Pakistan after the Russian invasion of 1979. Some 2 million had lived in Pakistan for decades, never in their native Afghanistan, but they would be coming. Still, General Nicholson kept saying that he would win in Afghanistan. Mattis didn't like it. The secretary is very unhappy with what he, Nicholson, just said, and we're trying to rein him in, one Pentagon official privately confided. If the language of the commander-in-chief was about winning, it was hard to criticize the ground commander for using it. But the intelligence indicated that it was heading to worse, not better, next year. In early 2018, one key participant said, "The military seemed to want a South Korea-style permanent presence. If so, Iran, Russia, and China will ramp up their antagonism because all of a sudden, we now have a permanent presence in their backyard. But the military may have got its way here because getting out would be a huge walkdown. The president said we're going to win, and you can't define that as stalemate forever. At some point, people are going to recognize you can't succeed there." Quietly and nervously, some officials at state and the intelligence community began some extremely sensitive scenario planning, a Plan B. The military does scenario planning all the time. Why not the civilians? The analyst described the outcome of this Plan B. It's not a withdrawal and a collapse and civil war. It's not a liberal democracy deeply centralized. What's in the middle? Federalist, more realistic, more sustainable, to give potentially the Taliban a role. The sort of wild card is the president's short attention span and his questioning all these assumptions that people keep throwing out, and smelling and calling bullshit when he sees it. For example, saying things will work out with Pakistan. But Pakistan has not changed since 9/11, and they won't. The only option, then, is to get out. In summary, Afghanistan was a new house of broken toys. Political instability, fraying of the Afghan government, congressional and public criticism in the United States, few, if any, military gains, drought, massive food insecurity, refugees. Trump blamed two people in particular. First, he had a special scorn for former President George W. Bush, who had started the Afghanistan War in 2001 and then the Iraq War in 2003. "A terrible president," he told Porter. "He was a warmonger. He wanted to exert American influence and take democracy all throughout the world and wanted to be the world's policeman and started all these wars. It was foolhardy and a mistake. Even though Trump had made the decision to add several thousand troops, he said he was not going to continue the status quo. The other person Trump blamed was McMaster. He used Iraq as evidence. I don't know how they've, the Iraqis, managed to fool McMaster, but he's not a businessman. They, U.S. generals, don't understand the cost-benefit analysis. I can't believe I let him talk me into putting more troops in there. He believed that McMaster had been co-opted. In a searing insult to McMaster, Trump did an imitation of his national security advisor. The president puffed up his chest and started noticeably exaggerated breathing. He said in loud staccato, "I know the president of Iraq. He's a good man, sir. I know he has our best interest at heart." Returning to his normal voice, Trump said, "That guy's just full of shit. I met this guy. McMaster doesn't know what he's talking about." Trump had met the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi at the White House in March 2017. "These military guys, they don't get business. They know how to be soldiers and they know how to fight. They don't understand how much it's costing." On Afghanistan, Trump told Porter, "It's a disaster there. It's never going to be a functioning democracy. We ought to just exit completely." Chapter 39. Trump and Senator Graham played golf at the Trump International Golf Club in West Palm Beach 2 weeks before Christmas, December 10, 2017. In a tweet, Graham said the golf course was spectacular, a comment sure to please Trump. It was nothing compared to the praise Graham lavished on Trump during their round. "You're a very good commander-in-chief," he told Trump. The president was listening to his military commanders, and the changes in the rules of engagement in the Middle East and Afghanistan were paying off. This was Graham's pitch to Trump. "You can do something nobody else did. You're cleaning up the mess that Obama left you. You're doing a damn good job of cleaning it up. You're rebuilding the military. You're taking a wet blanket off the economy. You're really unshackling the military and the economy. God bless you for undoing the damage done in the last 8 years. Where do you want to go? What do you want to be your legacy? Your legacy is not just undoing what he did, but it's putting your stamp on history." Trump seemed to love the adulation, but said to Graham, "You're a middle-of-the-road guy. I want you to be 100% for Trump." This resembled the loyalty pledge that then-FBI Director James Comey said that Trump had asked of him. According to Comey, Trump had said, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty," during their now-famous one-on-one green room dinner in the White House during the first week of the Trump presidency. "Okay, what's the issue?" Graham asked, "and I'll tell you whether I'm 100% for you or not." "You're like 82%, Trump said. "Well, some days I'm 100%, some days I may be zero." "I want you to be a 100% guy." "Why would you want me to tell you you're right when I think you're wrong? What good does that do for you or me?" Graham asked. "Presidents need people that can tell them the truth as they see it. It's up to you to see if I'm full of shit." On December 29, 2017, Trump's tweet had summarized his position on DACA. "The Democrats have been told and fully understand that there can be no DACA without the desperately needed wall at the southern border and an end to the horrible chain migration. We must protect our country at all cost." The president called a meeting in the cabinet room with 20 senators and House members to discuss an immigration plan for the Dreamers. Trump directed that the Tuesday, January 9th meeting be televised, all 55 minutes. He was in full performance mode, promising legislation. "Truly, it should be a bill of love, and we can do that." The president was engaging and fun. Graham was astounded at Trump's apparent shift on one of the most polarizing issues before them. The anti-immigration hardliners would be aghast. Trump had once been their leader. Graham hoped this was the president at his deal-making best. Graham had never felt better about Trump's ability to get an immigration deal done. He had worked on immigration for years, attempting to broker compromises with Democrats like Ted Kennedy, Chuck Schumer, and Dick Durbin. With Trump, he saw the potential to finally succeed. In a statement, he was exuberant, saying, "Most fascinating meeting I've been involved with in 20-plus years in politics." The headlines reinforced Graham's optimism. The New York Times: "Trump appears to endorse path to citizenship for millions of immigrants." The Washington Post: "At the table, Trump tried to negotiate and prove stability." The next day, Trump phoned Graham. "I thought you were masterful," Graham said. "Don't let all these people, Republican hardliners, scare you away. You're on track here. This is the guy that I try to tell people about when we play golf. This is the Donald Trump that I'm all in for. Only you can do it. Bush tried. Obama couldn't do it. You can do this." To Graham's surprise, Trump put Melania, the first lady, on the phone. "I just wanted to tell you I like what you said," the first lady said in her soft accent, "and the way you handled yourself, and the way you speak. I thought it was very nice." "Well, thank you, ma'am. You made my day," Graham replied. He was impressed with her grace. It was the first time he had ever really talked to her. It was pretty clear she, an immigrant herself, was sympathetic to the DACA children. "Can we change the libel laws?" Trump asked, rapidly shifting the tenor of the conversation to one of his pet peeves. "No," Graham, the lawyer, said. "Why?" "We are not England," Graham said, "where the libel laws were stricter." "People were writing bullshit," Trump said. "I don't doubt it," Graham agreed. "But no, we can't change the libel laws, and don't worry about it." In the landmark 1964 decision New York Times v. Sullivan, the U.S. Supreme Court had set the libel bar about as high as possible. Something was libelous only if published or said, knowing that it was false and with reckless disregard for the truth. "Well, I don't intend to become like England," Trump said. "There's no more bigger punching bag in all the world than the President of the United States," Graham said. "And you've gotten more than your fair share of unfounded criticism, but that's just the hand you're dealt. And the way you beat them, Mr. President, is you produce. And the way you put your critics in a box is you don't sue them, you just deliver. Prove all these guys wrong." Graham felt it had been one of his best conversations with the president. He had done most of the talking. About 11 a.m. the next day, Senator Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, called Graham. "I just got off the phone with Trump," said Durbin, who had joined Graham in the efforts for a compromise on immigration. "He likes what we did. He wants you and me to come down." Graham called the White House to try to set up a meeting. Kelly came to Graham's office to go over details. Kelly, the immigration hardliner, was edgy. He had told the West Wing staff and even some on the Hill that the president didn't understand what DACA was, that he was ignorant of both the policy and the mechanics. The president had deputized Kelly to handle DACA, and he viewed part of that job as making sure Trump didn't do anything or meet with anyone on DACA, like Graham and Durbin, without him there. "The president can't do this on his own," he'd told West Wing colleagues, "because if he does it on his own, he's going to screw it up." "All I'm asking for is a chance to explain to the president," Graham said. Graham's plan was simple, he repeated. Trump would go along with legislation for Dreamers in exchange for funding for the wall. "Let him make up his own mind," Graham said. He was repeating Kelly's mantra on all issues. He wanted the facts presented to the president, who could then decide. So Graham and Durbin showed up at the White House, thinking they would meet alone with Trump. Instead, there was a group of anti-immigrant senators, congressmen, and staffers, including Kelly and Stephen Miller. Graham thought it looked like a lynch mob lined up on chairs in the Oval Office. Graham began walking through the plan, which included the money Trump had asked for on border security. "It was not enough," Trump said, condescending. Graham said he was sure they could do more, but this was where they had started. And he mentioned 25,000 visas from mostly African countries. He turned to the visas for places such as Haiti and El Salvador because of earthquakes, famine, and violence. "Haitians," Trump said. "We don't need more Haitians." At that, and the mention of immigrants from African countries, Trump said, "Why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here?" He had just met with the Prime Minister of Norway. Why not more Norwegians or Asians who could help the economy? Durbin was sickened. Graham was floored. "Time out," Graham said, signaling for a halt with his hands. "I don't like where this thing's going." "America is an ideal," he said. "I want merit-based immigration from every corner of the globe, not just Europeans. A lot of us come from shitholes." Trump snapped back to reasonable, but the damage was done. Durbin went public, revealing Trump's comments about shithole countries, and Graham backed Durbin up. 2 days later, Saturday, Trump called Graham, who thought Trump was calling to take his temperature. How mad was he? Trump said he was playing golf at his club in West Palm Beach. "Well, hit him good," Graham said. "I didn't say some of the things that he said I said," Trump said, referring to Durbin. "Yeah, you did," Graham insisted. "Well, some people like what I said." "I'm not one of them," Graham said. "I want to help you. I like playing golf with you, but if that's the price of admission, count me out. Good luck. Hit 'em good." The idea of shithole countries was not a new one for Trump. During the 2016 campaign, Trump had visited Little Haiti in Miami. Former Haitian leaders had come to the microphones and accused the Clintons of corruption and stealing from Haiti. After the event, in private, Trump seemed down. "I really felt for these people. They came from such a shithole." With Bannon out of the White House, Stephen Miller was the driving force behind the White House's hardline DACA policy. Trump often still expressed sympathy for young people in the DACA program, saying, "A lot of times these kids came here through no fault of their own. They're sympathetic." He also pointed out the political appeal of the Dreamers. Miller would inject the hardline. "Look, everybody calls them the kids and the Dreamers, but," he argued, "they weren't kids anymore. Many were 24 or 26 or 27. Miller's position was absolute. In exchange for a compromise on DACA, "we want full border wall funding for a decade, not just 1 year, plus an end to chain migration and the diversity lottery that dispersed up to 50,000 green cards per year to immigrants from nations that otherwise had low immigration rates to the U.S. We're not accepting anything less than all three." On January 21st, Graham attacked Miller publicly. "As long as Stephen Miller is in charge of negotiating immigration, we are going nowhere. He's been an outlier for years. I've talked to the president. His heart is right on this issue. He's got a good understanding of what will sell, and every time we have a proposal, it is only yanked back by staff members." On Friday morning, February 23, 2018, Trump spoke at the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, the most important conservative audience in the country. Relaxed and brimming with self-confidence, the president spoke for over an hour. At times, he stuck to his prepared text, but he went exuberantly off the glass at points, speaking spontaneously. "You're getting the wall," he said. "Don't worry." Had a couple of these characters in the back say, "Oh, he really doesn't want the wall. He just used that for campaigning." I said, "Are you..." Can you believe it? You know, I say every time I hear that, the wall gets 10 feet higher.
You know that.
Every single time. Okay now, we're going to have the wall. On immigration, he said, I don't want people that are going to come in and be accepting all the gifts of our country for the next 50 years and contribute nothing. And I want people that love us. I don't want people coming in the way they do now. He then repeated one of his favorite stories, a rhyming poem about a woman who took in a snake. On her way to work one morning down the path along the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor, half-hearted frozen snake. His pretty colored skin had been all frosted with dew. Poor thing, she cried, I'll take you in, and I'll take care of you. Take me in, O tender woman, take me in for heaven's sake. Take me in, O tender woman, sighed the vicious snake. She wrapped him up all cozy in a comforter of silk, and laid him by her fireside with some honey and some milk. She hurried home from work that night, and soon as she arrived, she found that the pretty snake she had taken in had been revived. She stroked his pretty skin again, and kissed and held him tight. But instead of saying thank you, that snake gave her a vicious bite. I saved you, cried the woman, and you've bitten me, heavens why! You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm going to die. Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in. And that's what we're doing with our country, folks, Trump said. We're letting people in, and it is going to be a lot of trouble. It is only getting worse. Trump had just approved a 2-year spending bill for $8.6 trillion that had no money, not one red cent, for the wall. Trump's relationship with his Secretary of State was irrevocably fractured. There were months of speculation that Tillerson was about to quit or be fired. He was in Africa when Kelly warned him in March 2018 to cut his trip short. You may get a tweet, Kelly said. The morning of March 13th, Trump tweeted that CIA Director Mike Pompeo was going to be the next Secretary of State. Thank you, Rex Tillerson, for his service, was all he said about Tillerson. Trump told reporters on the South Lawn of the White House, Rex and I have been talking about this for a long time. We disagreed on things. We were not really thinking the same. Really, it was a different mindset, a different thinking. Chapter 40. Trump was continuing to complain to his attorney Dowd that the Mueller investigation was hampering his ability to act as president. He passed on some classified anecdotes that Dowd, who had a security clearance, could pass to Mueller and Quarles, who also had the proper clearances. Cautioning Dowd that it was very sensitive, Trump said one had occurred in April when he had personally negotiated the release of a charity worker, Aya Hijazi, 30, a U.S. citizen who had been imprisoned in Cairo for 3 years. Trump relayed his conversation with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who had an abysmal human rights record, including mass detentions, security forces killing protesters, and military trials of civilians. Dowd, remember who I'm talking to, he said. This guy's a fucking killer. I'm getting it done. He'll make you sweat on the phone. And right before we make the deal, el-Sisi says, and Trump assumed a deep, gravelly voice, Donald, I'm worried about this investigation. Are you going to be around? Suppose I need a favor, Donald. It was like a kick in the nuts. It's awful, Trump said. In November, Kelly called Dowd. The president said you're going to see Mueller. Yeah, we're going to see him in a couple hours. Mattis has told the president that Putin and the Russians are just getting too dangerous and that we're going to have to deal with them. And I want you to convey that to Bob. Bob knows Mattis. Mueller and the Secretary of Defense had both been Marines. Dowd described to Mueller how everything Trump did with Russia was suspect. Bob, I know you know General Mattis. Mueller had met with Mattis during a visit to Kandahar in January 2002 when he was FBI director. Dowd reported that Mattis was worried about Russia. And by the way, you want to check it? Pick up the phone and call him. He knows who you are. He knows you're a Marine. Dowd reminded Mueller that he'd said he wouldn't let grass grow under him. The grass is about a foot high, pal. We keep defending you with the president. Mueller said he was dead serious about finishing the investigation. Well, I gotta tell you, Bob, I don't know how long I'm going to last. I defend you guys all the time. I stand up for what you're doing. But you know, we got people being interviewed over and over again. With Mueller, Dowd pushed gently. With Quarles, he complained, enough is enough. Dowd had other problems. Ty Cobb started giving interviews to the media saying that the investigation would be over by the end of 2017. I'd be embarrassed if this is still haunting the White House by Thanksgiving, he told Reuters, and worse, if it's still haunting him by year end. The media ran stories with Cobb's picture. Dowd now thought Cobb looked like an old Western sheriff with a handlebar mustache out of the Western novel and miniseries Lonesome Dove, and he was astonished. He was the lead lawyer for the president. Was Cobb having separate conversations with Quarles? No, Cobb insisted. My wife wants me out of this, he said, and so I've been trying to nudge it along publicly. There's interviews scheduled in December, Dowd said, and frankly, they're all favorable to the president, so we're going to let them go. Kelly asked Dowd, where'd you find this fucking friend, Ty? Cobb had started off on the wrong foot with Kelly, going behind the chief of staff's back to the president to get an office in the West Wing. He told Cobb, don't you ever go behind my fucking back again. Dowd assured the president that their strategy of dealing with Mueller was to cooperate and grind them down until we had a 3D picture of what was in their heads. Based on this picture and the cooperation of 37 witnesses and all the documents turned over, he repeated several times, I don't see a case. Under Article 2 of the Constitution, Dowd explained to him, the president solely ran the executive branch, and all of his actions, particularly pertaining to Comey, were within those powers. I will never tell you that your instincts are wrong about these guys and what they're up to. We've been treated very nicely, but we treated them very nicely. In December, a story ran in the German financial daily Handelsblatt saying the Mueller investigation had subpoenaed records from Deutsche Bank, the largest in Germany, and the primary lender to Trump. The president called Dowd at 7 a.m. He was furious. I know my relationships with Deutsche Bank, he said. He maintained the bank loved him and always got paid. I know what I borrowed, when I paid it back. I know every goddamn one. He could recall whom he had dealt with and other details with specificity. I'm telling you, this is bullshit. Dowd pushed Quarles. Hey, Jim, there's no secrets here. This is bullshit. A conference call was scheduled with lawyers from all the relevant law firms. Everyone sounded like they were talking in code. Look, would you please, Dowd said. My guy does not talk in code. Finally, Quarles reported, there's nothing there. We had subpoenas to Deutsche Bank way back in the summertime, but it doesn't involve the president or his finances. At 10 a.m. on December 21st, Dowd went to see Mueller in an attempt to turn the tables. Often the best defense was to go on the offense. All the records have been produced, Dowd said. All the witnesses have been interviewed except one or two. The entire inquiry appears to be the product of a conspiracy by the DNC, Fusion GPS, which did the Steele dossier, and senior FBI intelligence officials to undermine the Trump presidency. The failure to investigate Comey's role precipitating the inquiry is a travesty. Comey's aberrant and dishonorable conduct demands scrutiny. The Justice Department Inspector General was investigating Comey's actions in the Clinton email case. Kicking the can to the IG undermines confidence in your inquiry, Dowd claimed. Mueller did not reply. Mueller and Quarles kept pushing. They wanted to interview the president. On January 8, 2018, Mueller dictated a list of 16 topics they wanted to ask. Nearly all dealt with Flynn, Comey, or Sessions. Dowd advised the president that list was not specific. "What I'd like to do is I'd like to push it even further so you have a better picture. You know, 16 topics? You're kind of guessing as to what they're going to ask you." "What are you going to do?" Trump asked. "Well, my idea is we're going to write him a letter answering these." They would present the facts as they saw them and make legal arguments, especially about the president's Article II powers, and do it like a Supreme Court brief. "We've given them everything," Trump insisted. "Why wasn't it enough?" He added, "I don't mind talking to him." Dowd and Jay Sekulow spent the next 2 weeks drafting the letter. Sekulow, a frequent commentator on the Christian Broadcasting Network and Fox News, had represented conservative, religious, and anti-abortion groups over a 30-year career. "How you coming?" Trump eventually asked Dowd. "Can I see it?" Dowd came to the White House residence on Saturday, January 27, 2018, around 1 p.m. The president gave him a brief tour, including the Lincoln bedroom. "You and I fit in this bed," he joked. "We could see ourselves in the mirror," Dowd joked back. "If you win this case," Trump said, "I'll give you the A tour. Takes hours. In my opinion, this is the most beautiful mansion in the world. There's nothing like it." Trump's son, Barron, came in with a friend. "Dad," Barron said, "he wants his picture taken with you. Is that all right?" "Sure." The picture was snapped. Trump and Dowd sat at a table with a view of the Washington and Jefferson memorials. "I would like to give you sort of a feel of what testimony could be like," Dowd said. "They would do a practice session, and we'll talk about a couple of these subjects, maybe Comey and Flynn, just lightly. You don't have to do anything to prepare, just come in cold. I want you to read our letter. I'm ready to sign it, but I will not sign it until you feel good about it, because it is a major submission. This tells Bob where we are and where we think he is and why you should not, why he doesn't deserve to ask you questions. If the questions seem harmless, don't treat them that way. And I want you thoroughly focused on listening to the words. I'm not a windy examiner. I like the short, sweet questions, and I like to build it. I'm very patient. And I'll give you the standard advice. Just answer the question. Okay? Got it?" "Yes." "When did you first learn that there was a problem with General Flynn?" "I'm not sure. I think when McGahn had talked to Sally Yates. But John, I'm not sure." Trump said that the acting attorney general had said that Flynn had told the vice president something that wasn't correct. "What did you do about it?" Trump said he didn't think he had done anything. "I think Don took a hold of it. And they worked. Did you call Flynn in?" "No." "Did you talk to Flynn at all?" "I don't know. There's something in my mind that he and Priebus called me." "Well, Mr. President, did you ever ask him if he talked about sanctions with Russian Ambassador Kislyak?" "No." "Are you sure about that, Mr. President? We have some evidence that there may have been such a conversation. Are you sure about that?" Dowd was aware that Priebus had given testimony favorable to the president. In one version with Priebus in the room, Flynn had said in front of the president that he had never discussed his Kislyak conversations with the president. Trump wandered off with a long answer that didn't mean much. "Look, let's get back to brass tacks," Dowd said. "Oh. Did there come a time when you had to let him go?" Dowd asked about Flynn. "Yeah. Do you remember how that happened?" "No. I think he had a letter of resignation. I don't mind telling you, I felt very bad for him. He had his shortcomings, but he was a hell of a nice guy, and I admired him. As you know, I love military guys. So that was the recommendation, and that's what I did." Priebus and McGahn had recommended that Flynn be fired. "Did they ever tell you about an FBI interview?" "I don't know. I can't remember." Dowd felt that Trump really couldn't remember. As he asked more questions, there was a lot that Trump said he couldn't remember. He found this understandable given the demands of the presidency. So Dowd went back to December 2016, just after the election, and asked more about Flynn. Well, was he making contact with diplomats, etc.? I assume he was. Did he talk to Kislyak? You know, I don't know. I know there were a lot of conversations among the staff. I think I tweeted out some things. On March 31st, Trump had tweeted, "Mike Flynn should ask for immunity in that this is a witch hunt, excuse for big election loss by media and Dems of historic proportion." "What was your position on the sanctions Obama approved?" Dowd asked. Obama had expelled 35 Russian diplomats, sanctioned several individuals and entities, and closed two Russian compounds in January 2017. "Well, my position was it gave me leverage." "Oh," Dowd said, "because everybody thinks you would be against them, because you wanted good relations with Putin." "No, I looked at them as leverage," Trump repeated. Based on the testimony that Dowd had reviewed, this was accurate. Dowd figured he was cruising pretty well. The 6-page memo the White House and Dowd had compiled on Flynn had much more information than Trump was now recalling. Dowd had given the day-by-day account of how the White House discovered that Flynn had lied to Mueller and Quarles, who had complimented the memo for its thoroughness. "Well," Dowd asked, "why did you tell Director Comey that? You kind of asked him to take it easy on Flynn. What was that all about?" "I never said," Trump said. "He made a contemporaneous memorandum of it," Dowd said, "reported it to his buddies." "I didn't say that," Trump replied. "John, I absolutely didn't say that." "Well, he says he's a liar," Trump said. He went full tilt on Comey. "The guy's a crook. He's a liar. He bounces between the Clinton email thing and making memos and leaking." The president had his critique down pat. He delivered it all, unleashed, nonstop. Dowd tried to interject. No way. Trump went the whole 9 yards. "Look," Dowd said after the storm had briefly subsided, "you can't answer a question that way. That is what they say is off-putting. It's not good, okay? Be polite about it." "Well, goddammit! Did he tell you that you weren't under investigation on January 6th? "Yes, he did." "He just meant on the salacious part, not collusion, right?" Dowd asked. "That was one theory in Mueller's team." "That's bullshit. He never said that to me." Dowd believed him since Comey had corroborated that there had been no investigation on anything at that point. The next 30 minutes were useless. "This thing's a goddamn hoax." Trump reprised everything he had tweeted or said before. Dowd could get nowhere. Trump was raging. Dowd worried that if he had been Mueller, that Trump probably would have fired him on the spot. It was almost as if Trump were asking, "Why am I sitting here answering questions? I am the President of the United States." What a mess. Dowd shrugged his shoulders at the waste of time, but he saw the full nightmare. It was quite a sight, seeing the President of the United States fuming like some aggrieved Shakespearean king. Trump finally came down from the ceiling and began to regain his composure. "Mr. President, that's why you can't testify," Dowd said. "I know you believe it. I know you think it. I know you experienced it. But when you're answering questions, when you're a fact witness, you try to provide facts. If you don't know the facts, I'd just prefer you to say, 'Bob, I just don't remember. I got too much going on here,' instead of sort of guessing and making all kinds of wild conclusions." Then, Dowd handed Trump the draft of the letter addressed to Mueller. The subject read, "Request for testimony on alleged obstruction of justice." A raw assertion of presidential power was printed in boldface. He could, if he wished, terminate the inquiry or even exercise his power to pardon if he so desired. Trump read the 22-page letter carefully, pausing to read several paragraphs out loud. He said he loved the letter. "You know, I've got a hell of a case here. I love the way it's organized." He admired the 59 footnotes. "This is just one of the best days I've ever had in this thing," he went on. His capacity to cycle between emotions from low to high was on full display. "It really is beautiful. I guess it's everything I ever thought of and better. Now I get it. I see what you're doing." "Yeah," Dowd said. "Let's push them to the wall. But you don't want me to testify." "No," Dowd replied. "Why don't we exhaust this thing? Maybe if push comes to shove, I'll suggest to Bob, give me the questions. We will answer them. And we'll make a script. You can come over, ask your questions, and he'll read the answers. How can you complain about that when you've trusted us on everything we've given? Plus, the president cannot possibly remember all this. And by the way, he would love to meet you and talk through this thing, but he needs the assistance of a script." "By God, I'll do that," Trump said. "That's great." "Well," Dowd said, "just imagine if you didn't have the script." "I don't know, John. We just went through that. You think I was struggling?" "Yeah, you are. But, Mr. President, I don't blame you. It's not that you're lying or you're bad or anything like that. Given your daily intake, just look what we've done this afternoon." There had been, during their conversation, several interruptions, two short briefings on world problems, and some classified documents for Trump to sign. How could he remember everything? "You know," Dowd continued, "that gets in the way of trying to recollect what happened 6 months ago or 9 months ago." "That's great," Trump said. "I'm with you. I don't really want to testify." The day after the practice session in the White House, Trump called Dowd. "I slept like a rock," Trump said. "I love that letter. Can I have a copy?" "No," Dowd said. Dowd had the president where he wanted him. On Monday, January 29, 2018, Dowd and Sekulow signed the letter. Dowd then arranged to deliver the letter to Quarles on February 1st. It would be just like in the movies, Dowd thought. Quarles was to walk down the street and hop into Dowd's parked car. They exchanged a few pleasantries and asked about each other's kids. "Well, here's your letter," Dowd said. "What's this?" "In response to your 16 topics," Dowd said, "and we kind of make our case. I leave the door open. I'm going to push for some specific questions. Think about it. You want to talk about it? Tell Bob let's get together."